Tunnels, snow, and Nevada at last. The Central Pacific had received the news that it was now free to lay its tracks as far as the eventual linking site with obvious joy. But by the winter of 1866, one thing was absolutely clear. Up to this point in this great race, the Union Pacific had been blessed with far more good fortune than the CP. While Durant had been staging his extravagant celebration, the Central Pacific was still struggling to complete its summit tunnel. Although the use of the Blue Goose's engine to haul up debris and lower timbers had helped move the work along, the agonizingly slow pace of cutting away the faces of the tunnel continued. Then, Mother Nature suddenly played her hand. Winters in the Sierras were always severe, but no one had ever witnessed anything like what took place in the winter of 1866 to 1867. 44 blizzards struck the mountains. One of these storms lasted 13 consecutive days without an hour of let-up. Drifts surrounding the summit tunnel piled up 40 feet high. These storms, one observer wrote, made the road impassable even for sleighs. The snow, when new fallen, is very light, so that a man without snowshoes would sink to his waist or shoulders. Into this the oxen would flounder, and when they lay down, worn out, they could be roused only by twisting their tails. Remarkably, the work on the tunnel went on. The Chinese, historian Thomas W. Chin, founder of the Chinese Historical Society of America, wrote, lived practically entirely out of sight of the sky that winter, their shacks largely buried in snow. They dug chimneys and air shafts and lived by lantern light. They tunneled their way from the camps to the entrance to the tunnel to work long underground shifts. A remarkable labyrinth developed under the snow. Despite the perseverance of the Chinese workers, progress on the summit tunnel continued at a snail's pace. It was a situation that James Strobridge simply could not abide. All too aware that if the Central Pacific was to be a real contender in the race with the UP, it had to get out of the mountains, he decided to take his most dangerous gamble. He was aware that as recently as 1860, a powerful new explosive had been developed. It was called nitroglycerin. Strobridge had heard stories of how accidental explosions of the chemical had demolished a Central American steamship and blown up half a block in downtown San Francisco. He had, however, also been told by construction engineers who had tried it on their projects that it was at least twice as effective as blasting powder. It was more than tempting, but did Strobridge dare use it, especially when the unstable chemical would have to be transported to the tunnel over jarring mountain trails? He was still making up his mind when he was informed that a Scottish chemist named James Howden was on the West Coast, and that he had the ability to mix the chemicals that created nitroglycerin right at the tunnel site. Strobridge quickly sent for Howden and put him to work making his powerful explosive. At first, it seemed as if a miracle had been wrought. Instead of the small amount of granite that the black powder blasted away, nitroglycerin tore away huge sections of the rock. And it not only tore the rock away, it pulverized it, leaving far less debris to be removed. In addition, unlike black powder, it produced no tunnel-filling smoke that choked those men working in the cramped quarters. Thanks to nitroglycerin, work on the rock faces progressed more than 2 feet a day rather than a few inches. Strobridge and his engineers were delighted. Nitroglycerin had proven that its reputation for effectiveness was well-founded. But as great progress on the tunnel continued to be made, the nitroglycerin proved to be as dangerous as it was reputed to be. Week by week, Chinese workers were killed in blasts set off when their pickaxes accidentally struck the granite face near where the explosive had been set. Others were killed when the volatile chemical exploded much sooner or much later than intended. Finally, Strobridge had to admit that the nitroglycerin was just too dangerous. They had to stop using it and go back to black powder. By this time, however, greater progress had been made on the tunnel than Strobridge or any of his foremen could have hoped for only a few months ago. And then, At 4 o'clock in the afternoon of August 28, 1867, as noise from yet another black powder explosion was still reverberating, beams of light shone into the tunnel. Gaping at the light, the workmen could see that it was coming from the torches of graders working through the night in advance of the tunnel. They had broken through. The Summit Tunnel had been conquered. Wiring the welcome news back to Central Pacific headquarters, Lewis Clement exclaimed, "Perseverance alone has conquered." It was an achievement that could not be overestimated. Clement, Strobridge, the Chinese workmen, and their foreman, working by hand under impossible conditions, had, in the words of a later observer, created one of the greatest moments in American history. Filled with relief at having put the most back-breaking and dangerous days of the Summit Tunnel building behind them, Strobridge's men looked forward to completing the conquest of the mountains. But then, their old enemy winter struck again. Some of the workmen actually turned the newly fallen snow into sport. "These storms were grand," engineer John Gillis proclaimed, as both Irish and Chinese workers tried to move about on long strips of wood that they were told the Norwegians called skis. Skiing had not yet been introduced into America, but ski-clad workmen began racing one another down the slopes. The welcome amusement, however, was short-lived. The snows kept coming, the drifts piled up to incredible heights, and before long, Gillis had a very different kind of story to tell. "Snowslides or avalanches were frequent," he wrote. "The storm winds, being always from the southwest, formed drifts or snow wreaths on the northeast crests of hills. Then these become too heavy, which is generally towards the close of the storms. They break off and, in falling, start the loose snow below. This slides on the old crust. Near the close of one storm, a log house with a board roof containing 15 or 16 workers was crushed and buried up at daybreak. Towards evening, a man coming up the road could not find the house and alarmed the camp, so that by 6 o'clock the men were dug out. The men in the house could count themselves among the lucky ones. In another enormous snowslide, 20 men died when the flimsy barrack in which they lived was carried clear down the mountain. Their bodies were never found. No one will ever know how many workers simply vanished when struck by other avalanches. There was constant danger, one railroad historian wrote, for as snows accumulated on the upper ridges, avalanches grew frequent, their approach heralded only by a brief thunderous roar. A second later, a work crew, a bunkhouse, an entire camp would go hurtling at a dizzy speed down miles of frozen canyon. Not until months later were the bodies recovered. Sometimes groups were found with shovels or picks still clutched in their frozen hands. Skiing. The Central Pacific workers who startled onlookers by racing down the Sierra Nevada slopes on skis were engaging in an activity as old as antiquity. Archaeologists have determined that the oldest known skis, found in Russia near Moscow, date back to 6300 BCE. Rock carvings in Bula, Norway, that were created in 4000 BCE include depictions of men using skis. And ancient records reveal that skiing was so revered in the Scandinavian countries of Norway, Sweden, and Denmark that the Vikings worshipped Ullr and Skada as the god and goddess of skiing. Records also disclose that in the Middle Ages, skis were regularly used by Scandinavian hunters, warriors, and farmers. According to other documents, by the 1700s, units of the Swedish army both trained and competed on skis. The first skis used in America were brought by Norwegians who had immigrated seeking to strike it rich in the California gold fields. It is more than likely that the CP Transcontinental Railroad workers who took advantage of the 1866 Sierra snows to don skis were men who had been recruited from the gold mines. According to Sierra Heritage magazine, by the 1880s, a network of ski trails connected the many gold mining camps and were regularly used by doctors and mail carriers. One of these mail carriers was Granville Zach Zachariah, who, according to Sierra Heritage, was a stunner. He comes up over the crest of the Enterprise Ridge, and before I can wink, he scoots down into Bloody Run, leaving a trail of feathery snowflakes in his wake like a tail of a comet. For at least the next half century, skiing in the United States was largely confined to the region where Zachariah had made his mark. But the introduction of newer and easier-to-use skis, more effective bindings, and various types of waxes designed to make skis go faster led to the beginnings of nationwide popularity. Perhaps the greatest development of all took place in 1936 at the Sun Valley Ski Resort in Idaho, and it had a railroad connection. As skiing in America became more popular and as ski trails became steeper, the greatest need was to get skiers to the top of the trails. Sun Valley's founder, Averill Harriman, who in 1936 was also the chairman of the Union Pacific, asked his UP engineers to design the nation's first ski lift. One of the engineers, James Curran, had earlier designed a continuous cable with hooks to unload bananas from ships. Curran created the same type of cable with chairs attached to the hooks. The ski lift was born, and skiing was on its way to becoming one of the nation's most popular pastimes. Once again, the CP's work was on the verge of being halted. But even with the snow in the ravines and canyons piled up as high as 60 feet, Strobridge was determined to get out of the mountains. Here, in the winter of 1867, as he had done the previous winter, he ordered the men to cut snow tunnels between their barracks and the work sites. Some of these tunnels, engineer D.O. Mills reported, were more than 200 feet long. Clearing snow from the tracks was an even bigger problem. At one point, Strobridge had some 5,000 men engaged in nothing other than shoveling the heavy snow. But, as one CP official lamented, it was found impossible to keep the track open over half the time, and that mostly by means of men and shovels, which required an army of men on hand all the time at great expense. Something other than shoveling clearly needed to be done. At the end of the previous winter, the CP at its facilities in Sacramento had built the largest snowplow ever constructed. It was 30 feet long, and its front end was shaped like the prow of a battleship. But even when it was pushed by 12 locomotives, the plow could not cut its way through the drifts. Now, Strobridge and Crocker were even more desperate than they had been when the seemingly impassable Cape Horn had blocked their path. They decided to try something that had never been done on any railroad in the world. Impossible as it seemed, they would attempt to put a roof over the miles of track that had been laid through the snowiest areas. It was decided, one official later explained, that the only positive means of protecting the road was by snow sheds. Although the expense of building a shed nearly 40 miles in length was almost appalling and unprecedented in railroad construction, yet there seemed to be no alternative. Lewis Clement, fresh off his Summit Tunnel miracle of construction, was chosen to design what would be more like giant wooden tunnels than sheds, built to withstand tons of cascading snow. The CP then hired Arthur Brown, a veteran bridge builder from Scotland, to head the construction. Before the immense undertaking was completed, Brown would have 2,500 men, including hundreds of experienced carpenters, working for him. Six trains running around the clock would be required to bring timber, spikes, bolts, and other needed materials to the building sites. Reinforced with iron braces, rods, and supports, the snow sheds were timbered, as one observer noted, as heavily as line-of-battle ships. Before the sheds were completed, Brown and his men used a staggering 65 million feet of timber and 900 tons of bolts and spikes. Equally staggering was the cost of the project, equivalent to more than $25 million today. But no one, certainly not anyone connected with the Central Pacific, could argue with the fact that it was worth it. Observing the way the sheds kept the tracks clear even during the heaviest storms, a writer for Van Nostrand's Engineering magazine put it simply, "They have conquered the snow," he wrote. They had overcome what one historian described as their most consistent and debilitating enemy. And with that success came the prospect of at last getting out of the mountains and continuing over the flat Nevada desert. But there was still a great amount of work to be done in the Sierras, including the building of at least a dozen more tunnels. Although the greatest number of workers had been assigned to the building of the tunnel at the summit, a smaller group had begun work on the other tunnels at about the same time. And while none of the other tunnels would be anywhere near as long or as difficult to construct as the summit tunnel, each would present its own challenges. Each of the tunnels had to be tall enough to accommodate the high smokestacks of the locomotives that would pass through it. Each had to be wide enough to allow two trains traveling in opposite directions to pass through at the same time. As one observer later wrote, "The approaches to all the tunnels were covered with men who worked day and night in three shifts of 8 hours each. Thus, time was saved. As an illustration of the hurry, I may mention walking 2 miles over the hills after dark and staking out the east end of Tunnel 12 by the light of a bonfire. At 9 o'clock, the men were still at work." They would continue working nonstop until all the tunnels were completed. As far as Strobridge was concerned, he would leave the supervision of their remaining labors to various of his foremen. He simply could not wait to tackle the Nevada desert, where he was certain he would make up for the time spent in the mountains. "It was necessary," Strobridge would later write, "to have the heavy work in Nevada done in advance of the main force, and 3,000 men with 400 horses and carts were sent to that point, a distance of 300 miles in advance of the track. Hay, grain, and all supplies for these men and horses had to be hauled by teams over the Nevada deserts for that great distance, there being no supplies to be obtained on the entire route." At the same time, construction boss Crocker was engaged in an undertaking that would, when completed, be regarded by many as one of the greatest feats of all. 3 huge locomotives and 40 cars loaded with tons of rails, spikes, and other materials needed to lay the tracks across the first portions of Nevada sat perched in the mountains. They had to be disassembled and taken over the summit, across snow-covered trails, and into Nevada. "We hauled locomotives over," Crocker would later recount. "And when I say we, I mean myself. We hauled them on sleighs. We hauled some of them over on logs because we could not get a sleigh big enough. After the iron horses and their tenders and cars were brought slipping and sliding down the slope, they had to be loaded onto wagons and dragged along a rough and muddy road. After this was done, a cavalcade of sleds and wagons followed with the tons of supplies." At the same time that Crocker was getting the vital supplies out of the mountains, and Strobridge was overseeing his army of graders in Nevada, CP track layers had begun making their descent down the Sierra's eastern slope. On December 13, 1867, jubilant Chinese workers set down the first rails across the Nevada line. Setting a standard. Although the work of the graders and the track layers was much more commonly known, the labor of another group for both the Central Pacific and the Union Pacific was every bit as essential. They were the gaugers, men who, as soon as tracks were laid, made certain that they were exactly the right distance apart to accommodate the wheels of the trains that would be traveling on them. In 1830, George Stephenson designed England's Liverpool and Manchester Railway, the world's first twin-track passenger railroad. He had set his rails 4 feet 8.5 inches apart, based on the width of the coal wagons of the day. This width between the rails came to be called the Stephenson gauge. In 1846, the British Parliament passed an act by which the Stephenson gauge became the standard gauge for all railroads built in England. Because England had pioneered railroad building, a significant number of American engineers went there to study railroad construction. Many of the early American railroads built by these engineers used the Stephenson gauge. However, the Charleston and Hamburg railway line was constructed with a 5-foot gauge. When nearby states began to build railroads to connect with the Charleston and Hamburg, they copied this gauge. By 1861, more than 7,000 miles of track with this wider gauge had been laid in the South. There were various reasons why some railroads turned their backs on the Stevenson gauge. Some believed that using a unique gauge size would prevent rival companies from connecting to their line. After the United States invaded Canada in the War of 1812, railroads in Canada were built with a 5-foot-6-inch gauge to prevent American trains from using Canadian tracks. As more people and freight traveled significant distances by train, often transferring from one line to another, it became essential that rail gauges be standardized. Despite the considerable cost involved, almost all American railroad companies adopted the Stevenson or standard gauge. So too did Canadian railroads. The Central Pacific and Union Pacific, however, had no need to convert. From the time they began building the Transcontinental Railroad, both companies faithfully adhered to the Stevenson gauge. News that the Central Pacific had succeeded in laying tracks through the mountains quickly spread. Soon, the first train ever to carry passengers through the dense, towering Sierras made its way to a hastily erected temporary depot near the California-Nevada border. For the train's passengers, it was a thrilling experience. For the laborers who had made it possible, it was a most rewarding sight. "The Chinese worker, with his patient toil," wrote one observer, "has broken down the great barrier of the Sierras at last and opened over it the greatest highway yet created for the march of commerce and civilization."